This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Generally, one finds that when things are going well, there is an atmosphere of optimism in the world, or in that society in which things are going well. And when things are hard and rough, then there's an atmosphere of pessimism and negativism. Which means that the optimism and the pessimism is generally generated not by the individual, but by his circumstances. And that's what I want to examine with you this evening. The fact that optimism and pessimism are really midos, they are characteristics, they are subjective characteristics, and in essence, the human being has the capacity to be optimistic. And optimism is no chap when things are going well. That's not an optimist. An optimist is a person who feels positive when things are going well. He's not a positive. He's not an optimist. It's not a reason to feel pessimistic. And a pessimist who feels negative when things are going bad is a pessimist. An optimist is a person who is able to feel positive in bad times. And a pessimist is one who feels negative even in good times. That's what we're referring to. And we're going to discuss optimism as a middle. We're learning in the Shir on Shabbos morning about Eiv, Job, who is overcome with a sense of negativism and pessimism in his awful situation, in a situation where he finds himself afflicted with the harshest of afflictions imaginable, terrible suffering, pain, misery, the loss of everything he has, both financially, materially, and also family, socially, personally. Everything that he has and everything that he holds precious is taken away from him very suddenly after a life of plenty. And all of a sudden he finds himself confronted with this bleak future, totally void of any kind of meaning, of any kind of constructive possibilities, subjected and subdued by this awesome weight of his circumstances, and a situation from which he sees no possibility of fleeing. He sees no escape route at all. He's burdened with it. There's no way out. There's no survival. There's no recovery possible. This is just the end of things. The situation of Eiv is designed to describe the most pessimistic circumstance that one could possibly imagine. That's the situation in which Eiv finds himself. And in that situation he turns and adjusts his belief to hold that since God must be just, and since God must be omnipotent, and since he knows that he has not sinned, he can only assume that his fate has been abandoned to the forces of nature, to the forces of the world, to the cycles of physics, and to the astrological forces of the world, and that he is not being controlled by any kind of private and personal godly attentiveness. The Ribbono Shel Olam has abandoned his lot to the forces of nature. That's how he lives with his belief in God and with his intolerable situation. It's not God's fault. Just that's how it is. Nature. These things happen. And Bildad gets upset with him and says to him, how can you say that? Even what you're saying now is unacceptable. Hakel ye'avis mishvot v'imshada ye'avis tzedek. Does the Ribbono Shel Olam distort justice? Does God distort righteousness? It's all very well saying that you've been abandoned to the force of nature, but who abandoned you to the force of nature? Who did such a thing to a man who's so righteous? You hold you righteous, and yet you're able to believe that God abandoned you to the forces of nature and allowed nature to wreak havoc with your faith to this extent, to rid you of everything that you have and everything that you possess, which means you're attributing that distortion to God. God abandoned you to nature, according to what you're saying. On what basis are you entitled to attribute to God such distortion of justice, such neglect of charity? And Eve answers and he says, Omnam yodati kichen. He says, I know that. You're not telling me anything new. I believe in God. I'm not questioning God's omnipotence and his sense of justice and righteousness. That's not what I'm suggesting. All I'm saying is, Umay yitzdak eno shimke. How can a human being come right with the Ribbono Shel Olam? My problem is not with a belief in God, says Eve. I believe in God. I believe that He's all-powerful, I believe that He's righteous, I believe that He's merciful, I believe He would never do anything distorted or distort justice and charity in any way, whatever. But my yitzdak enosh in kev. What I don't believe in is that the human being is at all relevant and meaningful to the Ribbono Shel Olam. He has bigger things to worry about. I believe the universe is so enormous. I believe the extent of the world is so infinite. I believe God's concerns are so massive and so broad. I believe that this God straddles the universe and manipulates this enormous, infinite concept that a few human beings on one of the planets revolving around the sun, that doesn't play a part very much in God's will. It's not terribly important to Him. That's my problem. I have no belief in the greatness of man, in the greatness of God I believe, in the power of God I believe, in the omnipotence of God, and His mercy, and His justice, all of that I believe in. But not in man, being important enough to demand anything from God, and to expect anything from God, because man is irrelevant in the picture. As one might say with a human being, one might have a very just human being, and a very fair human being, a very honest and fine human being, and yet when he walks down the road he stands on a few ants on the way, and the ant comes along and says, what kind of just human being is this? Where's his righteousness? Where's his fairness? I was just scurrying along doing my business and he came and put his big foot on me, trampled me. What did I do to deserve it? What's the answer? You didn't do anything to deserve it, just didn't notice you. That's all. You're just unimportant. You don't exist in the broad frame of things. You weren't noticed. It wasn't deliberate. No, don't read anything into it. Just you were unimportant. Says Eve, I believe that man is so unimportant in the world, in the scheme of things, that man has no part to play. Man is not central in any way to God's dealings, and therefore one must expect that in the enormous goings on of this fantastic universe, here and there a man is going to get hurt, and that's just how life is. You've just got to accept it. That's how Eve comes to terms with his situation. Now Yaakov this morning said, finds himself in a similarly pessimistic situation. Yaakov is fleeing for his life, fleeing from a brother who is intent on killing him, and with good reason. And the brother is intent on killing him and is a master murderer. The brother has not yet been intent on killing anybody and not succeeded. This is a man who knows how to kill, who knows how to murder. Far stronger, far more powerful than Yaakov. And Yaakov is on the run. And for 14 years he hasn't slept. He's been learning Torah in the yeshivas of Shem Ve'Ever. He's been totally dedicated to Torah. Now he finds himself on the run, and his possessions, what does he have? Absolutely nothing. Eliphaz has come to kill him at the instructions of Esau, and he's managed to fob Eliphaz off by giving Eliphaz everything that he has. He hasn't got a brass penny, nothing. All his material possessions gone, and he's fleeing for his life. And where's he fleeing to? Where's he going to? That's not like a South African emigrating who's leaving a part of the place and going to another part of the place. That's not what it is. He was leaving the home of Yaakov, the home of Yitzchak, and the home of Rivka. That's what he was leaving. The source of his Torah he was leaving. He was leaving the Yeshiva Shem Ve'Ever, leaving without anything in his hand. Not like South Africans who are entitled to take 100,000 rand with them wherever they go, and even though that's only $40,000 or whatever it is. No, with $45,000 you can at least catch a taxi still from the airport to wherever you go. You can't do much more than that, but at least that you can do. He didn't even have that. Nothing, not a thing. Not a dollar, not even a rand. And where's he going? To Israel? To America? To Australia? To Canada? He's going to the home of love. Out of the pot and into the frying pan. Into the home of a deceitful crook. A murderer and thief. An Oved Avodah Zorah, a Kofer Bakum. Not only is he going to a place where he won't find a minion, he's going to a place where he won't find another Jew, he won't find another person who shares his belief in monotheism. Not one is going into a land of Avodah Zorah, into a land of idolatry. He won't have one person with whom he has a common language. He won't have one person when he walks through the streets with his beard and his tails, they won't stare at him. Not one person, everybody will stare at him. Everybody will mock him. Everybody will make fun of him. Every single person. There isn't one person who will have any respect for everything he stands for. And on the contrary, he's going to the home of a man who's such a crook and such a deceitful being, who's going to try and make sure that he gets nothing, that he has nothing, and will kill him in the end of it as well. Fleeing from Esau, and where's he got to go? To Lavan. With what? With nothing. Can you imagine anything more pessimistic? Any situation more negative, more bleak, more black? And he lies down to sleep for the first time in years. And he has a dream. And when he wakes up from the dream, he says, this is a very special place. And he takes the stone which he had placed at his head to protect him from all the little creepy crawly animals in the area. Vayosem oiso matzevo, and he set it up as a pillar, as a sort of a monument. Vayitzek shemen al roisho, and he poured oil onto its head, onto its top. Vayikro shem hamakom hahu beiskel, and he called that place the house of Hashem. And he says, "V'ha'even hazois asher samti matzevo," and this stone which I have placed as a pillar, as a foundation stone, yiyeh beis elokim, this will be a house of God, this will be a beis hamikdash, this will be a yeshiva, this will be a place of learning, a place of kedusha. Look where he's going. Look what the world looks like. He's the only survivor. There's Avrom, who had one son that was fit for the inheritance, Yitzchok. Yitzchok had one son, that's Yaakov. Yaakov is fleeing from a murderer into the hands of a murderer. And he hasn't got a penny on him. What is the future for such a man? What is the future for the Jewish people? We start worrying about what the future is for the Jewish people when things look a little bit negative. After the Second World War, people asked, what is the future for the Jewish people? What is the future for Torah? People thought there was no future. In Yaakov's case, one Jew left in the world, and that Jew is being hunted by somebody intent on destroying him, and his only place of refuge is right into the hands of somebody else who's equally intent on destroying him. What is the future of the Jewish people? Is there a future? And what's Yaakov busy doing? Building Beis HaMikdashes, building yeshivas, planning the future. And not maybe. This stone will be a Beis HaLikim, he says. This stone will be a house of God. His mind is towards the future, towards building, towards constructing the establishment of the Beis HaMikdash. He sees Eretz Yisrael, he sees the Shvotim, all these hundreds of thousands of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, having been brought out of Mitzrayim, with the Torah having been given. He sees them living there with the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, with the Kohanim and the Avedo, everybody coming to Yerushalayim every Yom Tov. He pictures it all in his mind at that moment of blackness, at that moment of bleakness. There we see the optimist, the ability to picture a future when to the ordinary person there doesn't appear to be a future. That's Yaakov the optimist. Unlike Eve. But what is the essential difference in their personalities? Where does it come from, this difference? How do they establish, what is this difference in character? we analyze Yaakov a little bit more carefully, we see over and over again. Firstly, we see it in this very episode that we've just learnt. He doesn't look around and say to himself, "Oy vey, what'll be? I'm the only Jew left, and I'm being hunted, and I've got nothing, and look where I'm going, and will I ever come out? I'm going to a place where there's no Torah, I won't have a Chavrusa, I won't have a Rebbe, I won't have a Talmud, I won't have a Sefer, nothing. I won't have a Chumash, I won't have a Sidur, I won't have a Gemara, nothing, absolutely nothing. That's where I'm going, and I am the Jewish people. There isn't anybody else. What future has the Jewish people got? It doesn't." Immediately he begins to plan. Immediately he begins to build. His feeling is, his approach is, "The fact is I'm alive. The fact is I've escaped the hand of Esav. Today, we don't know about tomorrow, but today I'm alive. What can I do today for the future?" That's all he's concerned of. "I'm in Yerushalayim, I'm in the place which will become the Yerushalayim, which will become the Beis HaMikdash. Let me start building it. Right now, I'm here, and I'm alive. My question is not to look around and say, oi, what will be? My function is to look around and say, why has the Ribbono Shel Olam put me here today? On the Mokom Beis HaMikdash, what am I here to do?" Start building the Beis HaMikdash. And Yaakov lays down the first stone for the Beis HaMikdash. How similar an episode in modern times to the story of the Ponovizhirov, I think my father related it when he was here, who found himself miraculously in Switzerland at the outbreak of the war, or at the time when Lithuania was invaded. And he was in Switzerland on his way to America as a representative of the Lithuanian government. He was a member of the Lithuanian parliament, and he was going to the American government to ask them to take Jewish refugees from Lithuania into America. By the time he got to Switzerland, he had news that Lithuania and that his town Ponovizh had been totally wiped out, that his wife and his family and everything that he had been utterly lost. A Yaakov situation. So he looks around, where is he going to go? Lithuania is destroyed. Who are the Jewish people? What's left? A few individuals in America, a few individuals in Israel. What did others do in such situations? There are people who lost their faith. If that's what God does, I don't want part of it. There are people who lost their faith. There are people who started compromising. We've got to establish Torah, and in order to re-establish Torah, it's got to appeal to the masses, and we've got to deal with politics, and we've got to establish the state of Israel. That's all a part of it, but that isn't Torah. Ponovizhirov said to himself, there and then in Switzerland, I'm here, I'm alive. I was on my way to America on a particular mission. That mission no longer applies, but the fact is I'm here and I'm alive. And he went through in his mind what on earth he might have been saved for. Have I been saved to teach Torah? He said to himself, there were greater teachers than I, and they've been wiped out. Have I been saved because I'm a tzaddik? He said to himself, there are greater tzaddikim, and they've been wiped out. I've been saved. Have I been saved because I'm a great rog to establish a new rabbonus? He says there were greater Rabbonim, he said to himself, and they weren't saved. So in what area am I the greatest? Why would the Ribbono Shel Olam have chosen me rather than anybody else? What does he want of me? And he thought it through, and he came to the conclusion that he was the greatest among the Rosh Yeshiva, among the Rabbonim, in administration, in building institutions, in building organizations. And he realized there and then that he was saved for the restructuring of Torah in the post-war period. And he felt that the place that would occur would be in Eretz Yisrael, and he immediately altered his course and made for Eretz Yisrael, chose Bnei Brak as the place to build. There was nothing there at all, absolutely nothing. And he went with people, one of the people he was with told me that they stood on the hill on which Ponovizh lives, as a sand dune. And at that time, he and the Ponovizhirov stood on top of that sand dune and looked out over all the sand dunes. There was nothing there. Sand dunes, absolutely nothing else. And the Ponovizhirov said, this will become a Mokom Torah. This is where the place of Torah will be constructed and where it will be built. And he went around building it there and then. Was there a future for Yiddishkeit? Absolutely not. one occasion when I was visiting with Rav Meir Soloveitchik, he said to me, told the story many times, he said, on your way out of my home, have a look in the shul next door. There's a shul right there. He says, have a look inside and see what you see there. I didn't know what he meant. So I had a look on my way out. The shul, it was dark, the lights were off. But they were playing ping pong. There was some youth were playing ping pong in one of the side rooms. When I came back a few days later to have another session with him, I'd already forgotten about the episode. He said, I asked you to look in the shul on your way out. Did you look? I said, yes, I looked. He said, what did you see? I said, I saw some children playing ping pong. He says, I want you to know that in 1948 that shul was full of people davening and learning, and they used to think that my father was a meshugana, because my father said, no compromises, Torah will not be compromised in any way, we will establish yeshivas the way the yeshivas used to be, we will run Torah the way Torah used to be, there needs to be no concession to any modern generation. And they thought he was mad. What kind of future is there for such a Yiddishkeit? That had just been destroyed in Europe. There was no future for it. Is that the Yiddishkeit we're going to bring to Eretz Israel? And there they were working out that we've got to have things for the youth, and we've got to involve the youth, and we must have judo clubs and ping pong clubs, and we must have the synagogue must become a center, and it must attract people into it, otherwise Yiddishkeit is dead. And now he says, go into my father's yeshiva, and you'll see the walls are bursting. And you go in there, and what do you find? They're playing ping pong. That's what's left. But at that time, they thought my father was mad, he said. Absolutely mad. To think of the restructuring of Torah, of pure, uncompromised Torah, in the mid-1940s, who could have thought of such a thing? It's as mad as a Yaakov Avinu. Look at such an absurd thing. Can you imagine this on a stage? The story of Avron, Yitzchak. Finally they produce a Yaakov, the sum total of the Jewish nation, one person, Yaakov, and his aging father, Yitzchak, and his violent brother Esav, intent on destroying this Yaakov. Yaakov without a penny, without any resources, without any material wealth at all, without any possessions, never mind wealth, on his way from Esav into the hands of Lavan, and he's busy pouring oil on a stone. Just imagine the scene. The curtain's open and there's Yaakov, Act 3, busy pouring oil on a stone. And somebody always says, Yaakov, what are you doing? He says, I'm building the Beis HaMikdash for the Jewish people. Yerushalayim is going to be our capital, you see. And there are going to be lots and lots of people, different tribes all over the country. And here there's going to be a Beis HaMikdash with Kohanim, busy bringing sacrifices. And all the Jewish people are going to come, hundreds of thousands of them on Yom Tov. And the yards of the Beis HaMikdash are going to be full. And this is the foundation. Call a doctor. Mad. Yeah, an optimist is mad. An optimist has to be mad. An optimist has to be able to see in the bleakest hours, what is it? What is the reason for which I'm here? Bleak it may be, but I'm alive and I'm here. That means I have a function to do. I have a purpose. What is the purpose? One Jew happens to be fortuitously on the place of the Beis HaMikdash, with a stone which has been created miraculously. Don't forget, Yaakov put 12 stones around his head. And when he woke up in the morning, there was only one. And Chazal tell us the stones, each one wanted to lie close to the head of Yaakov. Each one wanted to serve Yaakov. Each one wanted to lie under the head of Yaakov. And the stones argued, and in their argument, they fused together into one stone. That is the stone Yaakov looks at and says, what's happened? These 12 stones have become one. And I just had this magnificent dream on this place. Angels going up and down, the Ribbono Shel on the top of it. I've had a dream about the Ribbono Shel. And I find myself on Mokum Beis HaMikdash, and I'm alive. What am I alive for? What has the Ribbono Shel done this to me for, to put me in this place? That's mad. That's meshuggah. That I should be alive is crazy. That I should have had such a dream is crazy. That these stones should all have come into one is crazy. That's all crazy. So why did this crazy thing happen to me? It must be to begin the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. It's true we're going to have to go through all sorts of difficulties before this dream finally comes to fruition, but it needs to be started now and by me. That's why I'm here. And he takes his stone and he pours it as oil, and any passerby would have thought that Yaakov had lost his mind. And so would any psychiatrist have thought so. Yaakov realizes that the human being is created for what he can contribute, not for what he can take. We're not on the world to take. If we were on the world to take, then he would have a reason for pessimism. Oy, what have I got? I'm supposed to take and I've got nothing. I'm running from a murderer, I'm running to a murderer, my life is in danger, my possessions don't exist. Yaakov realizes my function is to contribute, to build, to establish, to lay foundation stones. That's what my function is. And he realizes that also from what happened with these stones. When he realizes that these 12 stones became one, he realizes the power of the human being. That man can change life. That man can change matter. That 12 stones can become one. That's the power that a man has. And I have to use that power. And he realizes he's got to contribute. And he starts right away. When a man realizes he's got to contribute, he simply looks around and he says, what are my resources? What do I have? And all Yaakov could find was a stone and a bit of oil. That's all he had, and that's what he used to lay the foundation stones of the Beis HaMikdash. Later on, Yaakov goes to Lavan. If Yaakov was a contemporary South African, he would have spent his 20 years with Lavan planning his emigration. Where he'll emigrate to, how he'll emigrate, trying to get the assets with which to emigrate, how to get the assets out of Lavan's house. That's what he would have spent the 20 years doing. His learning would have gone to pot. His Yiras Shamayim would have gone to pot. His Menuchas Nefesh would have gone to pot. And at the end of the day, maybe he would have emigrated, but his emigration would have been worth nothing. He would have had nothing to take with him. Yaakov finds himself in a country, as we've said, of children's education. What children's education was there? Nothing. Yeshivas? No yeshivas. Bes Yaakov? No Bes Yaakov. Jewish day schools? Nothing. Any moral sort of place where he could send his children? No. None. In the home? In whose home is he? At least are his children safe in the home? No, they're in Lavan's home. Absolutely no environment. You find people who talk, got to move, got to leave. Why? Children's education. No good. It's a good reason. One has to worry about a child's education. It's difficult to live in a place where there's not good education. But look where Lavan, where Yaakov was. Absolutely no education. Community life? How many shuls? Not one. Where did he go to daven? With a minyan? No minyan. Hear Kriyas HaTorah? He couldn't hear Kriyas HaTorah for 20 years. Go and hear a good shiur, couldn't hear a shiur. Read a good sefer, learn in a good, there were no sforim. Sit down and teach, so there's nobody to teach. Absolutely isolated. With no money, with no Torah, with no future. And what does he do during those 20 years? How does he leave after that? Take Yaakov Avinu and put him in a situation like that. What does the man leave with? One would expect him to leave broken, desolate, degenerate, chas v'sholem. Look how he leaves. He's able to say as he comes out, im lovon garti v'taryag mitzvah shamati. He's able to say when he comes out, for 20 years I lived with that road and I kept every mitzvah, every halach. I never did anything wrong during those 20 years. That's what he's able to say when he comes out. What does he come out with? He's able to say to Lavan, did you find a teaspoon in my property of yours? Did you find a pair of socks in my laundry that was yours by mistake? 20 years we lived in your house. Did anything by mistake creep into my possession that I should be guilty even unwittingly of geneva? Not one little matchstick did you find. That's how careful I was. That's how he comes out from 20 years. He comes out with children that he can call Ochai. Children that he can call my brothers, and the Medrash says, Ochai begadlus, Ochai betzitkus, as righteous as him, as great as him, as wise as him. He produces a community. Was there a community there? No. He made a community. How did he make the community? With his own children he made the community. Was there a yeshiva there? No. He built a yeshiva there. He made his own yeshiva there. With his own Talmidim, with his own children were his Talmidim. He comes out with wives of the caliber of Rochel and Leah, of Bilo and Zilpah, sons, daughter. Look what he comes out with. And wealth. How did he do that? By spending the 20 years planning his emigration? Or by saying, 1 minute, I'm here now, what can I contribute here, what can I do here? I've got to establish a business, I've got to establish a yeshiva, I've got to establish a mokum Torah, I've got to establish a kehillah. The fact that I might leave at any time, tough luck. Right now I'm here and I've got to look around and say, what are my resources? I'm a man on my own. But look what a man on his own can do. A man on his own can find a wife, they can have children, and they can start a community. They can live a life of Torah in an environment of tumah, in an environment of defilements and decadence. They can establish an island of perfection and of Torah. And in that island, they can create, and they can build, and they can develop. That's the understanding of the importance of contributiveness, which is that same Yaakov that we found 20 years earlier, standing on the Mokom Beis Hamikdash, saying to himself, what can I do here? What do you mean, what can you do here? Just look after your survival, run, that's what you can do. No, there's a reason I'm here. I'm alive and I'm here. And I'm here to do a job of work, not just to survive, I'm here to live. And living means contributing. Living means being productive. Living means generating. Living means making. Living means investing in the future. And I'm alive and I'm here and I have a job to do. What can I do? And he comes to the conclusion, I must build a Beis Hamikdash. And when he finds himself in the home of Lavan, I'm alive. What can I do here to contribute? He builds a home, and he builds a family, and he builds a kehillah, and he builds a Beis HaMedrash, and he builds a yeshiva for his children. He builds an entire community, and he builds a business. That's a Yaakov. How careful we have to be in every situation not to look at what we can take from it, what it can provide for us. It's important. We have to see that we're in the right kind of sviva. We're not all Yaakov Avinus. We're not all people that can survive in an environment of a lava. But having found the best environment one can, one has to look and say, I'm here, I'm alive, what are my resources, what can I build, what can I make, what can I do, what can I contribute? That's how the person has to operate. And therein he finds his optimism. That it doesn't matter how bleak or how black, it doesn't make any difference. I've got to invest. Once a person is busy with investment, once a person is busy with expansion, once a person is busy with developing opportunities and nurturing opportunities, once he's busy contributing to others and to his society, then he becomes optimistic. Then he feels optimistic because he sees the future. He doesn't know exactly what way it's going to go, but his mind and his effort and everything that he's putting in is into a future. A future for Am Yisrael, a future for Klal Yisrael. There's a lovely Gemara that we did in the shiur this morning, where Rabbi Yossi says in Chagiga Daf Yud Beis, Oy lohem libriyos shiroyos veinan yoidos maroyos. Woe betide humanity who sees and they don't understand what they see, who stand and they don't know upon what they stand. And he goes on in a very peculiar way. Ha'oretz al ma'u medes, what does the land stand on? Al ho'amudim, it stands on pillars. And he brings a pasuk from that same perek of Eve, where Eve says, Hashem is so great, I have no difficulty believing in the greatness of Hashem. On the contrary, I believe he's so great that man is insignificant. Hamargiz eretz bimkoimo, the Ribbono Shel Olam shakes the earth out of its place. V'amudei yispalotzun, and the pillars of the earth tremble. So you see, says Rabbi Yossi, that the earth stands on pillars. Whatever that means. Amudim, what do the pillars stand on? Al-Homayim, the pillars float on water. And he brings a posuk. La-Roi-Kohoret al-Hamayim. Mayim, what does the water stand on? Al-Hehorim, it stands on mountains. Shenema, it says, Al-Horim yamdu mayim. Horim, what are the mountains supported by? The Ruach. The mountains are supported by atmosphere. Ruach, what is the atmosphere supported by? Se'orah. It's supported by a storm. It says, Ruach Se'orah Oiso Devorah. And Se'orah, what supports the storm? Tuluyo Bizroyo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is suspended from the hand of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So Rabbi Yossi has created this rich image of the arm of the Ribbono Shel Olam suspending a storm. So you've got Hashem's hand, so to say, and hanging down there is a storm, and on the storm there's atmosphere, there's air, and upon the air there are mountains, and upon the mountains there's water, and upon the water there are three pillars, and upon the pillars is the earth, the world. That's the way the earth has to be pictured, says Rabbi Yossi. And Elohim Libriyus Sheroyus Venan Yodis Maroyus Shaimdim Venam Yodim Amaimdim. Woe betides humanity who sees and doesn't know what they're seeing, and who stands and doesn't know on what they're standing. Why woe betides? What's the terrible thing if you don't know that? In what way does that change our lives? If you see this magical picture of Rabbi Yossi, very pretty, very beautiful. But in what way does that change our lives? Why is Rabbi Yossi so concerned that chas v'sholom you might find people who don't know this? Very serious. It's a terrible thing if they don't know this. Why does that change our lives? Explains the Marsha that this is all an image, it's all a metaphor. The amudim on which the world stands are not real pillars. We know the world doesn't stand on pillars. It's the three amudim referred to in Pirkei Avos, Al HaEmes, Val HaDin, Val HaSholem. The world stands on three pillars: truth, justice, and peace. All three have to exist. Take one leg away and the world collapses. If peace is achieved by sacrificing justice, the world will collapse. If justice is achieved at the expense of peace, the world will collapse. If truth is there but there's no peace, or peace is there but there's no truth, the world will collapse. All three have to exist. And those three are supported on water. Says the Ma'ashoah and Mayim El HaTorah, water is Torah. Those three are supported by the Torah. Only the Torah can synthesize these three opposites, because Din and Sholem and Emes, they don't really go together. When you paskin a Din, when you decide a legal matter, usually you make somebody unhappy. You don't create peace that way. People don't come out friends from court cases, but if it's based on Torah, they do. Both feel gratified that the truth has been discovered. If there's Emes and there's Torah, then there can be Din, even with Sholem. The two can go together. If there's Sholem, can there be Emes? Sometimes to keep the peace, one has to tell lies. Not if there's Torah. If it's all based on Torah, one can be Emes, and there can still be peace. People want the Emes, and they appreciate the Emes, and they're willing to subject themselves to the Emes, however unpleasant it might be. The Emes is important to them, if it's based on Torah. So if these three pillars are floating on the sea of Torah, says Rabbi Yossi, then the three pillars can exist simultaneously. And what is the Torah supported by? It's supported by mountains. And the Ma'ashoah, all this he proves with Psukim. Mountains is the metaphor for tzaddikim. Mountains are the metaphor for Tamidei Chachomim, people who've elevated themselves from the earth. It's the earth elevated, a human being uplifted. That's what the mountain is. Torah can't exist in a vacuum. Torah has to be vital. Torah has to be dynamic. Torah has to flow. It has to move with the times. And the Tamidei Chachomim calls that to happen. It's they who are creative in Torah and who generate the Torah and who make it all work. So if the Torah is supported by Tamidei Chachomim, then the Torah can support the three pillars, Din and Emes and Sholem. And the Tamidei Chachomim, what makes them tick? Ruach. Those mountains are supported by Ruach, is the Neshoma. Atmosphere is the soul. The Talmid Chacham needs a Neshoma. And he uses his neshoma to elevate himself. He uses his neshoma to become a Talmid Chacham. He uses his neshoma to hold the water up, to hold the Torah up, that can in turn hold those three pillars up. And his ruach, what drives the spirit? What gives force to the neshoma? The se'orah, the storm. And what is the storm? And in this very perek of Eve, there is an image of a storm, but the storm is spelt with a samach, with a sin, says the Ma'asho. Sin ayin reish hei. Se'oro, which comes from the word seir, which is Esav. Seir is Esav, is Edom. That's the Yetzer Hara. the two Seirim that we bring on Yom Kippur, the one that goes to the Azazel and the one that becomes a Korban Seirim, Yetzer HaTov and Yetzer Hara. So what is the Seora? It's the storm within the human being, the storminess that he has, the storm that he has of fighting his Yetzer Hara, of overcoming his weaknesses, of becoming great. That's the storm which feeds the soul, which makes him into a Talmid Chochem, which contributes to the Torah, which supports the pillars which hold the earth. And the storm? Who supports the storm? How do you come out victorious when one's battling with oneself? Tehle b'zroya shel HaKadosh Baruch. There the tzaddik needs siyata d'shmaya. If he makes the effort, and he decides that that's what he wants to do, the Ribbono shel Olam supports him. So there you've got the hand of the Ribbono shel Olam, holding up the storm, enabling the storm to come out right and to produce the wind. The wind which is the spirit which produces the Talmid Chochem, who produces the Torah, who supports the three pillars on which the earth stands. That's the image of Rabbi Yossi. And at the end of it, Rabbi Loza ben Shamua says, Al Omud Echot, the world really stands on one pillar. And what Rabbi Loza ben Shamua is saying is, Rabbi Yossi, all of your image must be seen as one massive pillar. And what is that pillar? The tzaddik shumoy, that pillar is called a tzaddik. And he quotes the pasuk of tzaddik yisoid olam. A tzaddik is the foundation of the earth. So what does Rabbi Yossi mean when he says, Oilohem libriyos, shiroyos, feinam yodos, myroyos? Woe betide humanity who sieve and they don't understand what it is, who perceive and they don't understand what it is they are perceiving. Who's standing and they don't understand on what they're standing. What is that? Why is that so important? Says Rabbi Yossi, you Eov, you look at the earth and you say, God is so great, he's so wonderful, he deals with such enormous things, he shakes the earth so that the very foundation shakes. You've got it wrong, Eov. You're right that there's an earth which sometimes shakes, and you're right that there are foundations which sometimes shake, but you think the foundations are shaking because God's shaking the structure. The opposite is true. The tzaddik is the foundation, and when the earth is shaking, it's because the foundation is shaking. It's because the tzaddik is weak, not because the Ribbono shel Olam is shaking it. Man determines the circumstances, not the circumstances determine man. Everything that happens in the world is a consequence of the tzaddikim. The tzaddikim are not consequences of circumstances. We don't view man as the tail and circumstances the dog. Man is the dog and he wags the circumstances. And while it's true that we can't always create our own circumstances, but we can certainly operate with them, and it is in our hands to decide what effect they have on us. That was the brilliant discovery of Viktor Frankl in the concentration camps. It's all very well that I had no control. I landed up in a concentration camp, wasn't my choice. But that, says Viktor Frankl, is not an excuse for losing your faith. And that is not an excuse for losing your humanity. Because others too ended up in the same situation and they came out great. They came out saints. And therefore you can never blame the circumstances, no matter how bad the circumstance is. It is within your power to determine what effect that circumstance will have on you. And that's the secret of optimism. Not to sit and blame the circumstance and project all one's interests and all one's attention on the circumstances and woe betide the circumstances and what will become of me and what will be and what is the future. That's not how the tzaddik operates. The tzaddik says, I determine what the future is. Circumstances, what happens, I can't control. But what circumstances do to me or what I do to circumstances, that's entirely within my control. Is there anybody in a worse and a more miserable situation than Yaakov at that moment? What does Yaakov do at that moment? Lose his faith? Become negative and pessimistic? Yaakov lays the foundation for the future of the Jewish people. Yaakov finds himself in the house of Laban. What does he do? Spend all his time equivocating, should I emigrate or shouldn't I emigrate? No, he says, this is where I have to be right now, and right now I'm going to make a contribution here. And I can't sit and say, there's no Jewish education, and there's nothing good enough for my children, and there are no business opportunities, the government takes everything I'm earning, which as much as it might be true here and in many other countries, was much more true in the house of Laban. Poor man didn't have to pay income tax. He had no income. Whatever he made was income tax. There was nothing else. He had no worries about declining currency because he had no currency. So if anybody was there to bemoan the situation, it should have been Yaakov. I'm here to make a contribution. No schools, I'll make schools. No yeshivas, I'll make yeshivas. There are no people, you'll tell me. There are no children for the schools. I'll make the children for the schools. There are no people to daven with. There are no chavruses. I'll make people. I'll make chavruses. I'll get married. I'll have children. We'll establish a family. And they'll be my chavruses. And they'll be my talmidim. And they'll fill the schools. And they will fill the shuls. You don't sit there and bemoan the situation. This is where I have to be. Let's roll up our sleeves and let's build and contribute. I'm in a miserable circumstance. That might be true. But that's not going to make me miserable, says Yaakov. But Ribbono Shel'Olam has saved me. I'm alive. And alive means able to contribute. That means that Ribbono Shel'Olam has preserved me in a situation able to contribute. And he has placed me in a particular place at a particular time, which means he wants me to contribute here. He wants me to build here. And the foundation is a tzaddik, bent over double, holding this earth on his shoulders. And the picture of Atlas, the only thing is they paint Atlas in a bathing costume with big muscles. That's not what Atlas looks like. So he's got a kapota with a long beard, payas, shtreimel, sforim under his hand. That's who Atlas is. He holds the world. Tzaddik yisoid oilo. The tzaddik stands at the foundation of the world. Eiv, you were so close. You pictured the world and you pictured the tzaddik. And you saw the world shaking and you saw the tzaddik shaking. You thought the tzaddik is shaking because the world is shaking. You didn't realize the world is shaking because the tzaddik is shaking. You can't blame the circumstance. You create the circumstance. And as rough as things are, Eiv, they're of your own doing. Shake yourself out of it and realize that if you are a tzaddik, you can reverse the whole thing, you can turn it around. There is nothing which is beyond the capacity of the human being. He's enormous, he's powerful, he's great, and he can achieve whatever he sets his mind to achieve with the siyata dishmaya that he needs. Says Rabbi Yossi, poor Eiv. He sees the image, royus, veinam yoidus ma royus. They see, but they don't fully perceive, they don't fully understand what they see. Eiv sees the tzaddik shake and he sees the world shake and he thinks the world is shaking the tzaddik. But in truth it is the tzaddik shaking the world. And that's why it's so serious if people don't see it, because if people don't see it, they miss opportunities. If Yaakov thought that he was shaking because the world was shaking, he wouldn't have established Klal Yisrael in the home of Lavan. He would have sat there bemoaning his situation, planning his emigration, equivocating and not being able to make up his mind about anything because his future is so bleak and so uncertain, not knowing where he was going and what he was doing, and no Jewish people would have been established at all. No, Yaakov doesn't take that view. Yaakov says, I'm here for a purpose, I'm here to contribute. What is the contribution I can make? And he gets busy making that contribution. That's the tzaddik yisoid oilo. And Yaakov uses that not only in negative situations. Yaakov uses that in positive situations too. Yaakov lies down in his place, as we've discussed, and he has this unbelievable dream. The Ribbono Shel Olam addresses him in the dream. The Ribbono Shel Olam speaks to him. He sees this ladder with angels going up and down. He sees the Ribbono Shel Olam in an image, communicates with the Ribbono Shel Olam, has a wonderful promise from the Ribbono Shel Olam. One would think that he would wake up euphoric, totally enwrapped in the magnificence of this existential experience. And what does he do? Let's look at him. The curtains open on the stage once again, and this is back to Act 2, and we see Yaakov waking up. And we've had the benefit, the producer has shown us on the side, while we had Yaakov sleeping on the one side of the stage, we had the dream being enacted on the other side. And so we were able to picture, we saw exactly what was going through Yaakov's subconscious mind as he lay sleeping for the first time in 14 years. And now the curtain opens for the second act and Yaakov awakes. And what do we expect from this? To see Yaakov in seventh heaven, bleary-eyed, with this look of supernatural experience, having seen the light and all these funny things. Yaakov wakes up with a frown on his face, worried, terrified. Vayomer, and he says, Achen yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh. V'anochi lo yodati. Hashem is in this place, and I didn't know it. Vayiro, and he was afraid. Vayomer, manayiro amochom hazeh. How awful is this place? What is he afraid of? Says Rashi, V'anochi lo yodati, shim yodati lo yoshanti b'makom kodesh kazeh. I had the chutzpah to sleep here, treating it as a bedroom, as a private home. This is the Mokum Beis Hamikdash. This is where the Ribbono Shel Shechinah is, and I didn't know it, and I fell asleep here. What have I done? All he's worried about is, have I put a step wrong in halacha? Have I done something I shouldn't have done? Yaakov, you've just had this magnificent existential experience, kabbalistic, all sorts of wonderful things. God spoke to you. Forget it. I'm not interested in that. Have I done anything wrong? Have I put a foot wrong? Have I mispracticed any detail of halacha? How could I have fallen asleep in a place as holy after 14 years of not sleeping? Worried. How could I have fallen asleep in a place with such kedusha? That's a Yaakov Avinu. He's not affected, just as he's not affected by his adversity, and it doesn't make him pessimistic, so his exaltation doesn't make him optimistic. He's just had the most optimistic revelation, and he wakes up worried, concerned. That's the ultimate realist. He decides when to feel comfortable and optimistic, and when to feel worried and concerned. Am I worried and concerned about my actions? That's all I have to worry about. I don't have to worry about, not that I don't have to care about, don't misunderstand me, but I don't have to lie awake at night worrying about whether the rand is going up or down, whether the blacks are going to get the vote or they're not, whether Mandela is going to be released or not. That's not what must keep me awake at night. What must keep me awake at night is, did I speak any Lashon Hora today? Did I earn any money unjustly today? Did I hurt anybody's dignity today? Did I say Kriya Shema with proper Kavona today? These are the things that Jews are supposed to be worried and terrified about. And if so, let me fix it. Who's got time to worry about Nelson Mandela and PWD? Who's got time to worry about such nonsense? What difference does it really make? Is that where the future of the Jewish people lies? Is that where the future of our own spiritual interests lie? Yeah, fine, it's a matter of interest and a little bit of care. But that's not an area of worry? And that all my thoughts have to revolve around that? Is that what Jewish life is? Is that what being a Yid is? Yaakov is not pressurized by the negatives, nor is he pressurized by the positives. And then one day, gold price shoots up, the rand strengthens, the stock exchange goes up, and everybody's feeling fine, wonderful. Stories of Mandela about to be released, sanctions being stopped, investment being reapplied, and everybody's feeling good. Why are you feeling better? Is your Yerushalayim on a higher level? Did you learn more today than you learned yesterday? Are you more of a tzaddik than you were before? Is your tefillah more correct than it was before? Have you been more careful about the way you've related to people than you did? Why are you so euphoric? What's happened to your neshama that made you so euphoric? So what do we see? What causes our euphoria and what causes our depression? External things. We're totally at the hands of our environment. The news is good, we feel excited. The news is bad, we feel miserable. Is that a Jew? Is that a human life? Is that stature? Is that building? Is that direction? Says Yaakov Avinu, I've just dreamt about the Ribbono Shel Olam. I've just had a vision. I've had nevuah. And I'm worried. How could I have slept here? Halacha. That's all I'm interested in. Have I done anything wrong? And a little bit later, when he recomposes himself, he looks around. I've got nothing. Not a penny. Running from one murderer into the hands of another murderer. Doesn't matter. There's a future. A Beis HaMikdash can be built over here. And he lays the foundation stone for a Beis HaMikdash. A man who is totally in command of himself, whose moods are not affected at all by what goes on around him. He sees what goes on around him, he knows what goes on around him, but that doesn't determine his moods. His own spiritual status determines his moods. The Gemara says about Avraham Avinu in the Dorim, that one of days. He's called Avram, says the Gemara, and he's called Avram. In the beginning, Hashem
allowed him to rule over 243 limbs of his body. 243 is the gematria of Avram. And then he gave him the extra hay, which is 5. And then he gave him mastery over 248 limbs. Hain, these are the extra 5. Shtei enayim, he gave him mastery over 2 eyes. Shtei oznayim, 2 ears. Verosh hagviya, and his sexual organ as well. Says the Ran, in the beginning Hashem allowed Avram to master his limbs, over which he has control, never to commit an avero. But his eyes and his ears, that's not in his power. Because you can't stop yourself seeing, you can't stop yourself hearing. We are affected by everything we see and by everything we hear. And Avram, when he was called Avram, before he was Avraham Avinu, Avram was not a master over his environment in that sense. Sure, he wouldn't commit an Avera. Sure, he used his hands and his legs and every part of his body he used to perform mitzvahs only. But he wasn't master over his eyes and ears. He couldn't avoid being influenced and affected by that which he saw and that which he heard. But afterwards, Kishenimul, after his bris, that's the essence of a Jew. That's the essence of the child of Avraham Avinu. Himlichla Kadosh Baruch Hu afilu al elu, shelo yistakel v'lo yishmo ki im dvar mitzvah. After that, Avraham Avinu didn't listen to anything or didn't see anything that wasn't a dvar mitzvah. Everything he saw and everything he heard was only dvar mitzvah, nothing else. He had absolute control over himself. Here we see that same concept expressed later on in his grandchild in Yaakov. Nothing outside of me is going to determine my moods. But you've got eyes, you've got ears, you hear bad news, you see bad things. Isn't that going to make you miserable? No, says Avraham. I'm Balabos. I'll decide what I look at and what I hear. I'll decide what will affect me and what won't affect me. I'll decide when to be happy and when to be sad. I'll decide what makes me happy and what makes me sad. I'm not going to allow myself to be at the ravages of whatever happens to be occurring around and about me. I will be master of my own emotions, says Avraham Avinu. That's the meaning of that extra hey, Avraham, he now has mastery over everything he does and everything he perceives. And that is the tzaddik, Yisrael. That is the tzaddik who is the foundation of the earth. He determines the quality of the earth. And that's why it is our tradition that all of our educational systems, the Lithuanian system, the school of the Vilna Gaon is such, where all the educational systems are designed to produce the few tzaddikim. Of course, in the process, we produce also a pretty high standard of general education. But the main thing is to focus on trying to make a few Chofetz Chaims, trying to make a few great people, a few tzaddikim, a few tamidei chachomim, because they are yesod olam. The status of the earth depends only on their status and on their stature. Nothing else is really important. Who wins the elections in America is not nearly as important as the caliber of tzaddikim that we produce. Because the president of America acts on the world. The tzaddik supports the world. And when he shakes, the world shakes with him. That's where our emphasis has to be. That's where our koyach has to be. And in conclusion, we might ask that we ourselves are not Avraham Avinus. We ourselves are not such tzaddikim that we can affect the course of history. The world doesn't rest on our shoulders. We are not these tzaddikim about which Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Lozov and Shemua are talking when they say tzaddik yisoid olam means that a tzaddik stands at the foot of the earth. There's another pasuk further on in Iyuv. Tole eretz al belima. The Ribbono shel Olam suspends the earth on nothing. Now, if one looks at it from an astronomical point of view, that makes good sense. There's the earth suspended in the middle of nothing. Tole eretz al belima. But what about the image of Atlas? Where's the tzaddik yisoid Olam? That's the same sefer, that's Iyuv, the same person talking. Earlier Eve said that the Ribbono Shel Olam shakes the earth and the pillars shake, and who is the pillar? We said Tzaddik Yisoid Olam, and that same Eve says later on Toile Eretz Al Belimo. The Ribbono Shel Olam suspends the earth on nothing. Where's that beautiful image of Rabbi Yossi gone to?
Says the Gemara, Omer Rabbi Yilo, Ein ho'eilom miskayim, elo bishvil mi sheboilim es atzmei bishas meriva. The whole world exists for the sake of one type of person. That's the type of person who can control himself in the midst of an argument. Why? Sheneemar, because it says, Toile Eretz Al Belimo.
That's what Iyuv means. Iyuv is describing to you what kind of tzaddik are we talking about. Are we talking only about a Chofetz Chaim? Are we talking only about a Yaakov Avinu? Only about an Avraham Avinu? Is that the kind of tzaddik we mean when we say tzaddik Yesod Olam?
No, says Rabbi Ilo.
Anybody who's able to control himself in an argument and not respond emotionally, but keep quiet, to suspend the earth on nothingness, on one who knows how to make himself nothing in the midst of the argument, in the heat of an argument, when one has just been insulted, when one has been infuriated, when one has been dealt an injustice, to be able to take a breath and see it all in perspective and keep quiet if that's the right thing to do. That's the kind of tzaddik who holds the earth up, who holds the world up. That's the tzaddik, as we learned last night, that Yaakov Avinu was. In the midst of the argument with Lavan, he's able to take a step back and to acknowledge that Lavan has a point, as the Ramban says. When Lavan says, everything you've got belongs to me, any normal person would say, what do you mean everything I've got belongs to you? You found nothing of yours over here, and everything I've got I worked for jolly hard for 20 years. Where have you ever heard of a father-in-law who makes his son slave to marry his daughters? That's what you made me do. Nothing I've got belongs to you. That's what a normal person would have said. Yaakov thinks a moment. And in the midst of his argument, Vayichar Yaakov, Yaakov is angry. He invites Lavan to sit at the top of his table. Because he says, you know, Lavan, you've got a point. You're a miserable wretch. You're a crook. You're a rogue. You're a murderer and a thief. But one thing is true, without you I wouldn't have anything. That is true. And therefore I owe you kovet. I owe you hakoros atoiv. And in the midst of the argument, he's able to respond to the dignity and self-esteem, to the kovet of lover. It's for tzaddikim like that, who hold the earth, that is the tzaddik yisoid olam. And that's what is meant by toilo eretz al belimo. He suspends the earth on nothingness. What kind of nothingness? The nothingness which exists in the heat of an argument, where the tzaddik closes his mouth and just lets things subside. He understands that there's no point in arguing, in responding, in reacting. Because what does it mean when you react in an argument? Who made you react? He did. I'm reacting to him. It's not my own choice. It's not an action, it's a reaction. And that's exactly what the Ovis aren't. Avraham masters his eyes and his ears. He sees what he wants to, he hears what he wants to. He's not affected by everything that happens. Yaakov is not made depressed by misery and is not made elated by existential experience. Yaakov decides himself what his moods will be. And in the midst of the heat of the argument with Lavan, he decides himself what words he's going to use, what response he's going to choose. Lavan doesn't dictate the terms, he dictates the terms. That's tzaddik yisoid olam. That's the essence of the yid. And that's where our efforts have to go, to understand that if we will take responsibility for what happens, not necessarily responsibility for what happens, it's not our fault if the rand goes down, not our fault if Mr. Mandela isn't released or is released. We don't have control over those things. But what we do have control is the effect that our environment has on us. Is it going to turn us into wailing, moaning, miserable little wretches who view the world blackly and pessimistically and cease to contribute and to build and to develop because we don't know where we're going? Or do we master ourselves and say that Ribbono Shel Olam has put us here at this particular time to do a job of work and to contribute and to build? If he moves us somewhere else, then we will build and we will contribute there just as we have here. It makes no difference where we are. The Ribbono Shel Olam has a job to do. I'm alive, I'm well. Live means I can build, live means I can contribute, alive means I can create. Whatever there is can be improved, whatever there isn't can be built, and that's my function. And I have to take a long view, a long term view of the future of Klal Yisrael, and to know that wherever Klal Yisrael is, they have a job to do, they have a future to live for,
and they have plans to be made.